It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule for Tuesday, January 14. Coming up on the podcast, the state destroys newborn screening tests. Target offers credit monitoring, but should you take it? We'll be getting a status report for the bees. And a St. Paul theater nearly shuttered a year ago is now planning years ahead. First, Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Yvonne Prettner-Solon will not seek re-election this year. She is a former state senator from Duluth, and she served as chair of an advisory committee on Capitol Security. Governor Mark Dayton must find a new running mate for his fall re-election bid. The agency overseeing the new Viking Stadium wants an opponent of the project to post a $50 million bond to cover any expenses related to the lawsuit. Matt Sepik reports.
Former Minneapolis mayoral candidate Doug Mann and two others sued the state last week. They claim it's illegal to use city sales taxes to pay off state debt. The lawsuit led the state to delay this week's planned bond sale. Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority Chair Michelle Kelmhelgen says if the delay drags on, the stadium may not open in 2016 as planned. She says the agency filed a motion to have Mann held responsible for the cost of any delay.
It would require the plaintiffs to post a bond so that there'd be some insurance that there was a way to take care of those potential damages.
Mann says he's unable to comment because he hasn't yet seen the latest motions in the case. Mann, who's representing himself, was not successful in a previous lawsuit against the stadium project. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The National Transportation Safety Board has released the preliminary report on a North Dakota oil train derailment and fire. Dan Gunderson has more.
The NTSB report confirms the accident near Castleton, North Dakota, started when 13 cars of a westbound grain train derailed. An eastbound crude oil train on an adjacent track crashed into a derailed car. Both trains were traveling slower than the posted speed limit for the track. The collision derailed 21 cars of the oil train. An estimated 400,000 gallons of oil spilled. Most of it burned when tanker cars caught fire and exploded, sending fireballs high into the sky. There were no injuries. Damage is estimated at $6.1 million. The NTSB is still analyzing a broken axle, two train wheels, and the incident recorders and onboard video from the locomotives involved in the crash. It will be at least a year before a final accident report is released. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
The Duluth City Council has passed a resolution that paves the way for a homeless Bill of Rights in the city. Dan Crocker explains.
A Bill of Rights would prohibit discrimination against someone based on their housing status. Three states have recently adopted one. Duluth would be the first city in the country to do so. City Council member Sharla Gardner says her resolution would call on the Duluth Human Rights Commission to draft an ordinance establishing the Bill of Rights. She hopes to pass it by the end of winter.
I want to draw public attention to the fact that homeless people are not treated in the same way by the public and by authorities as are people with jobs and houses.
Homelessness has been on the rise since 2007 and is at an all-time high in Duluth, where there's a severe shortage of low-income rental housing. As many as 200 people slept outside this past summer. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Minnesota Senator Al Franken ended 2013 with another strong quarter of fundraising for his re-election campaign. Here's Brett Neely in D.C.
Franken's campaign raised $2.1 million in the last 3 months of 2013. As the election year begins, Franken has $4.8 million in the bank. The campaign was quick to tout Franken's grassroots support, noting he received donations from more than 96,000 people last year, most of whom gave less than $100. Most of Franken's Republican opponents haven't yet announced their fundraising. The only one who has, businessman Mike McFadden, brought in $780,000 and has $1.7 million in the bank. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
The median sale price for a Twin Cities home rose more than 14% last year, our Annie Baxter reports.
The median price reached a five-year high by the end of 2013. It climbed to about $192,000 in the Twin Cities. Half the homes fetched more than that, half fetched less. Michael Hunstead is the president of the St. Paul Area Association of Realtors. He says the median price increase reflects the changing composition of the Twin Cities housing market. There are fewer sales of low-priced foreclosures and more sales of homes priced above $200,000.
In the $200,000 to $300,000 price range, which is more aligned with the traditional sellers, we're seeing more activity in that market.
With fewer foreclosures coming onto the market, the supply of homes for sale hit an 11-year low in 2013. And the amount of time a home is on the market prior to a sale keeps decreasing. The average is now 83 days, or under 3 months. Annie Baxter, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
A Minneapolis transgender woman who became a cause celeb among LGBT activists has been released from a St. Cloud prison. Laura Ewan has more.
Cece McDonald, who's 25, pled guilty in 2012 to manslaughter in the killing of Dean Schmitz. The year before, a female friend of Schmitz threw a glass at McDonald's face outside of a Minneapolis bar. Schmitz and his friends also taunted McDonald with anti-gay and racist slurs. Many of McDonald's supporters believed she was the victim of a hate crime, but prosecutors said McDonald acted unreasonably by stabbing Schmitz in the chest. Michael Friedman directs the Legal Rights Center, which represented McDonald. He says transgender people routinely face life-threatening rage from outsiders.
Self-defense can mean something different inside the mind of somebody who is trans and is well aware of people who have been murdered simply for being trans.
McDonald will serve the remainder of her 41-month sentence on supervised release. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
By the end of today, the state health department says it will have destroyed approximately 1.1 million newborn screening cards and test results stored in its archives. The agency's decision follows a recent settlement with 21 families who sued the health department for storing newborn screening DNA without parental consent. While the settlement ends a long-running court fight over the department's collection and storage practices, the battle over the state's archiving plan going forward appears to be far from over. Here's Lorna Benson.
Minnesota's newborn screening program collects blood spots on a card from all infants within 24 to 48 hours of their birth. The health department tests the blood spots for 55 genetic or congenital disorders for the approximately 200 babies born in Minnesota each day. Health researchers had used the stored material to ensure the quality and accuracy of the program by comparing old blood tests to new ones. They were also able to look for emerging health trends among newborns in certain ethnic groups or regions. But after the family sued, the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2011 ruled that the department's archive policy violated the state's Genetic Information Act. The settlement this week forced the destruction of the blood samples.
My hope is that they will learn a lesson from this and begin to respect the genetic privacy of individuals, parents, and children.
Twyla Brace is president of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. The health privacy advocacy group helped organize some of the parents who sued the health department. Brace says the parents were primarily worried about the many possible ways that the government might misuse DNA belonging to their children.
They could look at the two blood spots together, the genetic profile of two individuals, and say, you know what, the chances that you're going to have a very expensive child, and we can't afford it. You know, there are all these sorts of things that could happen if someone knew what your DNA said.
While the lawsuit was playing out in court, the legislature put new storage restrictions in place. The health department may now only store newborn genetic material for 71 days, unless a blood spot reveals an abnormal test result. Those positive tests may be stored for up to 2 years.
We are saddened by the outcome, but we are abiding by it.
Jim Koppel is the department's deputy commissioner. He says the destruction of the DNA material is unfortunate because it will stifle research into finding new tests that may help identify new congenital conditions. University of Minnesota professor Mark Schleiss has used the health department's newborn screening archive to find out if children who have unexplained hearing loss were exposed to a common virus before birth. He says his findings have confirmed the prenatal exposure in some kids, and that's given their parents a sense of closure. But Schleiss says he won't be able to find those answers anymore.
My heart goes out in particular to parents and families in Minnesota, because now they are being deprived of the freedom and flexibility as taxpayers, as citizens and parents, of having an option to help explain issues should they arise. In their children.
Schleiss says he will continue his research by working with screening data collected by other states, but other researchers may not be able to find a suitable replacement for the data. The legislature has asked the health department to submit ideas on what Minnesota could do with data from its newborn screening program if the legislature lifts the current restrictions on long-term DNA storage. Jim Koppel says his agency still has a huge interest in preserving access for researchers. He says the department will propose three possible options to lawmakers next month.
We are going to come to the legislature this year with a report giving them options on what we should be doing in the future around the storage and use issue, and we will abide by whatever they decide.
Twyla Brace with the Citizens Council for Health Freedom says privacy advocates are waiting to see what's in the report and are prepared to keep fighting to preserve their victory if necessary.
Lorna Benson on the NPR News Update. Many customers of Minneapolis-based Target are contemplating whether to sign up for a year of free credit monitoring. Target is offering the service in an attempt to reassure customers who are concerned about a security breach last month. The credit monitoring is provided through Experian, one of three major credit reporting agencies. So should you do it? Kathy Werzer asked that question to Ed Merzwinski, Consumer Program Director for U.S. PIRG, a Federation of State Public Interest Research Groups.
Do you think credit monitoring is a valuable service?
I think credit monitoring is an overrated service that is aggressively sold by Experian and the other credit bureaus, and it's used as a soporific, a way to kind of convince consumers that everything is okay. I would never pay for it. Never in my life would I pay for credit monitoring. But I understand Target is going to provide it for free, and it is not going to have an automatic renewal at the end. So in those circumstances, I'd take it for peace of mind. But it's not the first thing I would do after a data breach.
What would you do?
The first thing I would do is look at my statements on a more regular basis than I usually do. Look at them online, whether they're credit cards or checking accounts, and look for odd payments. Look for something you didn't buy that looks suspicious, and contact the bank if that happens. That's the very first thing. Second, any consumer who can avoid credit card debt should just simply use credit cards online and at the store. Debit cards are inherently dangerous. Even if the bank honors its zero liability policy, you're still missing money out of your account. You could have other checks bounce. You could have cash flow problems. It makes no sense to use a debit card if you can qualify for a credit card and avoid credit card debt.
If you happen to have a credit monitoring alert on your credit card, which alerts you if someone attempts to set up credit in your name, does that seem to work pretty well?
Credit monitoring does not prevent identity theft, and it does not raise your credit score. Credit monitoring warns you early that it's already happened in most cases, because credit is instantaneous. The bad guy can get credit pretty quickly. You're warned more quickly with credit monitoring, but it's not a great thing. I recommend to consumers that they use their own do-it-yourself credit monitoring. You're allowed by law a free copy of your credit report from each of the three credit bureaus annually. Why not get one every 3 or 4 months?
Of the information, Ed, that was reportedly stolen from Target, what's the most damaging to a customer?
The information from Target that was first reported stolen contributes to fraud on your existing accounts, your credit card number, your expiration date, and the security code from the back of the card can be used to do fraud on your existing accounts. But then it was later reported that, in addition, your PIN number was taken, although they claim that it was encrypted. PIN numbers are very short and easy to hack or to crack and figure out. And if the PIN numbers were taken, they could be used to get money right out of your bank account. If you've got the PIN number, you can create a cloned card and take money out of a bank account at an ATM machine. The third level on Friday is they admitted that names, addresses, and email addresses, phone numbers, a lot of information about you was also leaked. That information does not cause identity theft. You need a social security number and a birth date to cause identity theft. But what that information does do, if they've got your email address and your phone number, they can try to get you to give up the other information that they need. They'll call you on the phone and pretend to be from the bank. They'll send you an email with an exploding attachment that's designed to capture all the financial information on your computer. So I think that we've just found out that Target's problem is not just fraud on existing accounts, it's potentially identity theft by these phishing techniques of calling you on the phone. Phishing, P-H-I, is what it's called, or social engineering to get information from the customer.
Ed, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Kathy and Ed Merzwinski from U.S. PIRG. Forest tent caterpillars are expected to invade Minnesota in droves the next couple of years. Dan Crocker reports.
The native insects stripped the leaves off about 1 million acres of hardwood trees across the state last year. The Minnesota DNR predicts the population will peak this year or next before it crashes and slowly starts to build again, a cycle it repeats about every 10 years. The DNR's Mike Alber says the caterpillars don't harm healthy trees, but they do create a nuisance.
They can be smelly. You know, when you run over them on a road, they can get them onto your car and tires. It can be smelly.
Their cocoons also stick to houses, and their digested waste drops from trees. During the last peak in 2001-2002, about 8 million acres of forest were defoliated, mostly in northeastern Minnesota. Alber says the bugs munch leaves through May and mid-June, but trees typically refoliate by July. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
From one bug we don't need to one we do, two state agencies are focusing on ways to make the environment healthier for bees. The Department of Agriculture reports to the legislature tomorrow on a plan to review the use of popular insecticides linked to bee deaths. And the DNR is developing guidelines to improve pollinator insect habitat. The issue is also likely to be a hot topic during the upcoming legislative session. Dan Gunderson reports.
Pollinating insects face a sort of perfect storm. There are fewer flowering plants on the landscape. That affects insect nutrition. Honeybees suffer from persistent disease problems. And one of the most serious threats comes from a type of insecticide. In the last several years, the U.S. Ag Department estimates more than a third of the honeybee population has died each year. University of Minnesota bee expert Marla Spivak is working with a new team of U scientists to look for answers, but she says it's a daunting task.
I just spent the morning with a bunch of epidemiologists here on the chalkboard, and now by lunchtime they're looking at this thing going, oh my God. Where do we begin?
Spivak says a growing body of scientific evidence shows pollinators are affected by low levels of the insecticide, but scientists still aren't sure how much insecticide bees are exposed to as they travel from plant to plant. The legislature will consider funding some of that research. Neonicotinoid is a systemic insecticide. It's the most widely used and is absorbed by the plant in roots, leaves, and even pollen. Last year, the state legislature ordered the Ag Department to develop a process for reviewing the safety of neonicotinoid insecticides. Ag Commissioner Dave Fredrickson went beyond that requirement and ordered a regulatory review.
You know, as they say, the truth will set you free. And this has been such an issue, a contentious issue, that I just think it's incumbent on the Department of Agriculture to take a very serious look at it.
A report due to the legislature Wednesday will outline a process for that review. Deciding what to study will take about 6 months. The actual study is expected to take at least a year. The review could lead to changes in how or when the insecticide is used. Fredrickson says changes will be made only if the science strongly proves a risk to pollinators. Minnesota does have the authority to impose regulations that are more restrictive than the federal EPA rules. Commissioner Fredrickson says neonicotinoid insecticides are very important for protecting Minnesota crops like corn, soybeans, and sugar beets. The insecticide is also commonly used in urban settings and in greenhouse plants. Fredrickson says neonicotinoids are safer for people than other types of insecticides, but he says the risk to beneficial insects can't be ignored.
In significant doses, it would be harmful to pollinators, pollinator insects. And so we have to be able to learn how to manage that, or otherwise we're going to have to figure out a way to replace it.
In addition to the Ag Department review, the Minnesota DNR is developing guidelines for managing habitat to best provide food and protection for pollinators. Bee expert Marla Spivak says guidelines are a good start, But the University of Minnesota professor wants financial incentives and enforcement to make sure the guidelines are followed statewide.
For example, if you're going to say we need to plant flowers on roadsides and not spray them, then how are we going to make sure that people are not spraying their roadsides?
Spivak says there are grassroots efforts to make pesticide application records public and to get homeowners to stop using the insecticide. Lawmakers are also hearing about bees. DFL State Representative Jean Wagenius chairs the Environment, Natural Resources, and Agriculture Finance Committee. She's been surprised by the number of calls and conversations on the topic.
I think there's a lot of public interest. There is more here than I expected, and it's broader than I expected.
The public will have a chance to comment on pollinator plans from the Ag Department and the DNR over the next few weeks.
That's Dan Gunderson in Moorhead. After almost collapsing a little more than a year ago, Penumbra Theater in St. Paul, the nation's largest African-American theater, has announced a leadership transition. It's also unveiling an aggressive management plan. UN Care reports Sarah Bellamy will take over from her father, Lou, who founded the company almost 40 years ago.
Penumbra founder and artistic director Lou Bellamy told the crowd that packed the theater for the announcement that the evening was going to be one of looking back and forward. He recalled when the company put on its first productions in 1976, it was an uphill struggle.
In the face of negative and erroneous depictions of African American life, which was the norm in national, regional, and local theaters, we told stories of truth and gave honest depictions of black life.
Bellamy talked of the successes over the years, of the numbers of black actors trained at Penumbra who have gone on to careers elsewhere, regionally and nationally. But he also talked of the hard times, like what he called the near-fatal fiscal challenge of late 2012, when the theater had to go dark for some months. It came back after a wave of contributions from around the country. The crisis also caused the company to implement a five-year plan for growth and sustainability. Bellamy now sees a bright and stable future for Penumbra.
With the rock-hard confidence that Penumbra's horizons are wider and its leadership stronger than it has ever been. Which is why Penumbra's board of directors and I unanimously approve the appointment of Sarah Bellamy as my successor.
The leadership transition wasn't a huge surprise. Sarah Bellamy has been Associate Artistic Director at Penumbra for some years and is recognized for developing the theater's successful outreach program. As Lou Bellamy's daughter, she grew up at Penumbra. With the transition announcement, she becomes co-artistic director with her father. And then in 2017, during Penumbra's 40th season, Lou will retire and she will become artistic director. The younger Bellamy says it's her intention to meet the challenges of a changing world with the same commitment to social justice as Penumbra's founders.
Penumbra Theater is held to a high standard. Our ethics and our art are one. We don't do theater to entertain, though it is always entertaining. We do theater to practice better ways of being in the world.
Sarah Bellamy bluntly criticized other theaters in the area for mishandling portrayals of race and alienating communities of color.
Penumbra is bound by a social justice imperative that is central to our mission. It's in our very bones. I will not lose sight of that responsibility, and I will not allow it to be confused with a facsimile that takes the music, but not the words, that takes the people, but not their power, that takes the stories, but not the soul. There is a lot of that out there, and some audiences don't know the difference.
She says theaters of color are still vital to their audiences, and she pledged an aggressive outreach effort. That is also part of Penumbra's five-year plan, developed with the help of Michael Kaiser, president of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. He praised Penumbra for its plan to ramp up marketing to develop new audiences and also to raise more money and expand its board to make the organization more stable. He pointed out that while Penumbra is the largest African-American theater company in the country, its budget is only $2 million. He says, like other African-American arts organizations, Penumbra faces a challenge when it comes to donations.
The average mainstream white organization
gets 60% of its contributions from individuals, and the average African-American organization gets 6% of its funding from individuals.
Kaiser says he is confident, however, that Penumbra's plan is strong, and under the leadership of Sarah Bellamy, the company will continue to be a leader nationwide.
Arts reporter Ewan Kerr closes out the NPR News Update for a Tuesday. I'm Phil Picardi, so delighted to bring it to you. I'll have the Wednesday news right back here tomorrow.